Our last case this morning is the Chamberlain Group v. Tektronix Industries et al., 2016-27-13. Mr. White.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. The first and primary reason why this Court should vacate the preliminary injunction order from the District Court is that the District Court committed legal error in interpreting the controller limitation. It interpreted that controller limitation to be not only a self-aware controller, but it also cannot rely upon any external sensors to obtain status conditions for the garage door opener. Both of those portions of the construction were legally erroneous.
When I read the District Court opinion, I thought that there was an important ambiguity in the word rely. One thing it could mean is it doesn't have to use sensors. The other is it must not use sensors. Now, ultimately, I thought the District Court actually took the must not view, and that is subject to the, as far as I can tell, fairly conclusive response that that makes nonsense of Claim 2. But what about the somewhat more modest idea that what Claim 1 requires is the ability to be self-aware, even if you don't have to be self-aware all the time? That is, the ability to have information you're going to send to the smartphone that you did not acquire through a sensor.
I think the first answer to your question is I don't view the District Court's order that way, and I don't think you can view the order that way. When you look at what the District Court said, it was clear that it was interpreting it that it must not use sensors because it noted a couple points. That was the only way to distinguish the prior art.
Right, so we have to construe this claim and to figure out whether there is a substantial case of invalidity. Why is a construction wrong? I mean, I will assume for purposes of this question that the District Court did not adopt this construction, but why would it be wrong to construe Claim 1 in light of the spec to say the system has to be able to send information it did not acquire from sensors off to the smartphone, even if it also can do send information it acquired from sensors?
Sure. I think the simple response to that is that's not what's disclosed in the specification, and that would be contrary to the specification. If you look at column 4, which is the joint appendix, page 45, starting in line 5, there's a long discussion of what the operational status conditions are. But important to answering your question is the paragraph that begins on line 52. And that's where it goes through and talks about the controller that's being disclosed. And it talks about the controller can be or get information about the status conditions in multiple ways. It can be self-aware of them, but it can also use external sensors to develop them. So if you were to interpret Claim 1 as saying the controller must be self-aware, then I think you would eliminate half of what's disclosed in the specification, and the claims would not cover disclosed embodiments. So I think it'd be wrong on multiple fronts for you to do that. It'd be contrary to what's in the specification, and it would eliminate certain embodiments that are disclosed. So I don't think you can do it for those reasons.
In other words, when you read the limitation, a controller having a plurality of potential operational status conditions, you read that as meaning, as describing a controller that that has this information, but it doesn't. The claim doesn't describe how the controller got that information.
Absolutely. There's nothing that says how it obtains it. Nothing that talks about sensors, nothing that talks about not using sensors. There really is no support at all for the District Court's conclusion on either of those points, either that it be self-aware or that it can't use external sensors. And again, that's contrary to what's in the specification. The specification is clear as there's multiple ways to get information. One is using sensors, one's not using sensors. So if we assume the District Court got it wrong on this construction, then I think you have to vacate the preliminary injunction order because that is the sole and only reason that the District Court gave for denying our arguments and our presentation that the claims were invalid. If you look at page 10 of the order, that is the one and only reason that the court went against us on our issue of whether we not we raised
the significance. The other side in its briefing raises some additional limitations that are allegedly not met, disclosed by the prior art reference. Were those arguments also raised to the district court, and then the district court just simply zeroed in on this controller limitation?
There were discussions about other limitations. I don't think they rose to the level of the discussion of the controller. But the key for this court is, if we look at what the court actually concluded at below, is it was crystal clear that the only reason for deciding against us on a substantial question of invalidity was the controller limitation. So obviously the district court did not rely upon any other arguments. The order is not based upon any other arguments. So those are really not right for your honor's consideration here. We have to deal with the district court's order as it stands, the findings announced there. And again, on the issue of the substantial question of invalidity, the only distinction, the only thing the court relied upon was the sensor issue.
I guess the point is we wouldn't be able to conclude here in this court that there is, in fact, a substantial question of validity. If we agreed with you on this one particular claim,
well,
limitation,
I think
what the best we could do is simply vacate the grounds for the district court relied on, or the one ground for concluding that there was not a substantial question of validity.
I think you could go further, because I think from reading the district court's order, I believe it rejected any other arguments that would have distinguished the claims other than the construction of the controller. As you just asked.
But if we concluded that it was, the opinion just simply silent as to these other possible questions, then that would be grounds for vacating.
I believe that's right, but I think you can go further than that, and especially since Chamberlain has, they've tried to say that these arguments were definitely raised. If that's true and the court rejected them and relied only on the controller limitation, then I think you could go the step farther and say that there is a substantial question of validity that's been raised at this point. I think, as we've already discussed, the proper interpretation here is not what the district court did. The district court got it wrong for at least two reasons. It baits the construction that it came to on an erroneous reading of claim differentiation, as Judge Toronto noted. The idea that because Claim 2 talks about a sensor, the idea that you cannot then have a sensor in Claim 1 is just legally erroneous. And the district court also erred in interpreting Claim 1 based on an erroneous view of the prior art. The district court tried to interpret how the examiner differentiated the claims from the prior art and adopted a ground that was offered by Chamberlain's expert, but Chamberlain even runs away from that in its briefing and acknowledges that that's not the only distinction that was raised between the claims and the
prior art.
Just
curious, how come we didn't get the full office action response in the joint appendix?
I think we tried to
go on PAIR to go get it, and then I saw the full arguments that were made and whether or not the district court judge was right and how it understood what had occurred.
I think we were trying to keep the joint appendix small for you, and it was not an attempt to keep any information from your honors. It was just to focus on the key arguments there. And I would suggest that nothing else in the response would changed or affected the outcome there.
Can I ask, on the assumption that the district court misconstrued the claims and that the proper construction of Claim 1 is, as you say, it is completely neutral as to where information comes from, should we or should we not reach the non-merits components of the preliminary injunction standard? Because if we don't ourselves say there is a substantial case of invalidity, then it goes back, and at least potentially they ask for a preliminary injunction again, and then we would not have spoken about the question, is there monetarily uncompensable irreparable harm?
I think that that's fair, Your Honor, and I think it is proper.
That was just a question. Right? So,
I think you raise a good point. Is what's the most efficient way forward here? I think the more guidance that you all can provide to the district court, I think, would be helpful. I think we've seen the district court struggling with some concepts in terms of both irreparable harm and the merits here, and we even noted with respect to the second patent that's not subject to this order, that there were some clear, I think, struggles with the district court in understanding, you know, basic concepts of direct infringement. So I think it is proper.
Is there a trial now set for May?
It not yet. So the last time we were before the court, the judge was talking about possibly June, having a trial at sometime in June, but we do not have a trial date set yet. But the other issue that I think Your Honor should be aware of is there is sort of a spinoff of the preliminary injunction, which is a contempt proceeding that is pending right now. So the defendants in this case redesigned the product based upon the preliminary injunction order and released a new redesigned product. Chamberlain filed a motion for contempt, and we had that hearing last week. So the judge heard evidence on the issue and is asked for a post-trial briefing, which is due at the end of this week. And he intends to make some sort of pronouncement in the coming weeks on a contempt issue that is based, what we believe is on a clearly erroneous, you know, foothold here, which is the preliminary injunction order. So even though the trial is not set yet, there is some immediacy and some real concern from the defendant's side that we get some sort of resolution of the preliminary injunction order sooner rather than later. And we'd appreciate if Your Honors could do that for us. With that, unless there's other questions, I'm going to save what I've got left for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. White. We'll save the rest of your time for rebuttal. Ms. Vidal.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'd like to first address the rely language in the Court's opinion. When the Court used the term rely in saying that, and I'm on page 7 of the opinion, the appendix at 7, self-aware, i.e. that it did not rely upon any external sensors to obtain the status conditions of the GDO, and which it was able to transmit upon request, it was saying that the controller itself needs to be self-aware, it needs to be aware of its own states, and not determine those states based on external sensors. And the reason the court used that language is because through a three-day hearing with extensive testimony by experts, the court heard testimony from Dr. Ryan that the first clause in Claim 1 should be accorded its ordinary meaning. And if you look at the language of that claim, the language states a controller having, which is possessive, a plurality of potential operating status conditions defined at least in part by a plurality of operating states. There was a shorthand used during the trial, during the hearing, that language referred to self-aware. That shorthand comes from the specification itself. In column 4 of the specification, starting at around line 52, the applicant differentiated between information that is obtained by a controller that's self-aware, where the controller is aware of its own conditions, from actually obtaining that information from sensors. And the reason the applicant did that is because in the background of the patent, the applicant talked about the fact that external sensors were known in the art and they caused problems. External sensors included extra wiring, extra costs. I'm at the bottom of column 1 and the top of column 2. Extra installation time. And so what the patentee was disclosing in the specification is that there's two ways of doing this. You can either be self-aware, aware of your own states, and that's a technical term. Teva can apply here because it's a technical term dealing with state diagrams and being aware of your own states, or you can get information from a sensor that you're passing along. And the applicant didn't preclude the idea that the controller would get that other information. That's claimed in claims 2 and 3.
So can you address this problem of claim 2 being dependent on claim 1, which under 112D or 4 or whatever it's called, means that all of the claim 1 limitations have to be met by claim 2. For all the world, I don't see how under the district court's view, and I think under the view you're promoting, that's possible, because if claim 1 is limited to self-aware and only self-aware controllers not getting information from sensors, then claim 2 can't possibly.
So you're correct that claim 1 is not limited to that. Claim 1 discusses that the information that the controller is using in Claim 1 is self-aware information. That doesn't mean the controller can't also use information from sensors, but that sensor information can't satisfy that limitation of Claim 1. So when the judge says rely, the controller can't rely on external sensors to determine its own state. But it can both determine its own state, and the controller can pass through information from an external sensor. And I think Claim 3 is instructive on that point, because Claim 2, first of all, Claim 2 does not have any antecedent basis. Its claim differentiation is inappropriate. It's not modifying anything in Claim 1. It is adding to it. So Claim 2 adds sensors. Claim 3 says that the transmitter, which is a box in Claim 1, can take information from those sensors and send that out. So well, now you've got a transmitter in the upper left-hand column of, or the upper left-hand side of Figure 1, that can send information from the controller, the self-aware information, and it can also send information from the transmitter. So in my view, the proper reading of Claims 2 and 3 is that the applicant understood that you might not get completely away from sensors. You might still have some, but the invention was about the self-aware controller that monitored its own states, could send that out to, you might know that it turned on a light and might turn on another light based on the fact that it knows its own state.
Getting but, back to the district court's reasoning, I'm looking at towards the bottom of page 8. The judge concluded that the only reasonable way to reconcile the difference between Claim 1 and Claim 2 is that Claim 1 is choose condition sensors in favor of a controller that does not rely on external sensors. So it appears to be understanding Claim 1 as disclaiming condition sensors because it sees Claim 2 claiming condition sensors.
So none of the testimony from CGI relied on that. So the judge was hearing 3 days worth of testimony. The testimony was that you can't use that information to satisfy the limitations in Claim 1. So when the judge is making these statements, he's doing it on the backdrop of 3 days of testimony and extensive testimony from Dr. Ryan, who said that you can indeed have external controllers. He called it the Menard approach. It's the prior art approach. You can have those. You can add that into the invention, but you can't use those to satisfy the limitations of Claim 1. So Claim 1 precludes the ability to use that external sensor information to meet the limitation of being self-aware, because that's not, and again, I'm using the shorthand for self-aware. Over and over again, we reinforce to the judge that that is just shorthand. It's really the first clause in Claim 1 about the controller having potential status conditions. External controllers are not sending potential status conditions defined by states. They're sending their states. So there's a lot of testimony on this and clear differentiation between a controller who can know the states that it might be in versus a controller receiving an actual state of the garage doors closed from an external sensor.
Do you agree that the district court shouldn't have relied on the prosecution history as a way of understanding the limits to Claim 1?
I don't think the prosecution history is overly instructive here.
Okay.
I don't think we need to get there because it's not that we're trying to import some limitation into the claim, which in fact TTI is. If you look at their claim construction that they're proposing to the district court now, so, they're changing all the language.
So getting back to Claim 1, we're talking about a self-aware controller. I mean, that's how I should interpret that phrase in the first clause of the claim.
The first
clause. A controller having a plurality of potential operational status conditions. I should kind of, in my head, translate to being a self-aware controller.
That's the terminology the patent uses at column 4 is shorthand
for. Okay. And so I guess the next question is, how would a self-aware controller accomplish all of these different functions recited in Claim 5? Like, for example, detecting a likely presence of an obstacle to movement of the movable barrier to the garage door. I mean, I can understand a self-aware controller in the sense that it already knows that it opened the garage door, so it knows that, you know, the next action would be to close the garage door. Or the controller already knows that it believes it turned on the light, so it knows the next action it could take would be to turn that light off. And in that sense, it's self-aware. But I don't get at all how the controller could detect the presence of an obstacle to movement of the garage door unless it was relying on an external sensor.
So first I would say that Teva, I do believe, comes into play on this because the interpretation of whether those could be performed by the controller or the sensors, there was testimony on that, and Dr. Vine provided testimony on that. As to whether the garage door can detect an object, when there is an object, the garage door, which is starting to close, will reverse direction. So the garage door knows I reverse direction, and based on that, it could have logic to know that if it reversed direction, there's a likely presence of something in the way of the garage door. But there was
extensive... To get it to reverse the door, it needs to sense a reason to reverse the door, right? And that would require a sensor, wouldn't it?
It does require a sensor. There are sensors required by law at the bottom of the door, I believe 4 to 6 inches from the bottom of the door, that do detect the presence. But what's happening in that claim is that it's not relying on a state of, you know, state set from the external sensor that something is there in order to be self-aware. It's self-aware because it knows what its motor did. And yes, the motor triggered based on that, but the controller itself still has a state diagram and it still knows what it's doing, and it can detect the possible presence of of an obstruction based on the fact that it reversed direction.
So you're saying that, assuming my dog is at the base of the garage door and the door is closing, and then there's external sensors that recognize that there's some obstacle, i.e. my dog, blocking the bottom of the garage floor, then the external sensors will notify the controller, you need to reverse course.
Right.
And then once the controller is reversing course, you're telling me that that is information that now the controller possesses, that it now itself is detected the likely presence of an obstacle to the movement of the garage door. That's the theory.
That's correct as to if it's self-aware on that particular element. That is how it would be self-aware. And certainly if somebody were to just take the information from the sensor and the controller just sends that right out, that's not meeting the limitation of the claim, of claim one. It would have to actually be self-aware as to whatever that item on the list was. And again, there was extensive testimony that claim five, that those items in that list, the controller could be self-aware of them. It could also be that that information comes from an external controller, in which case that would not satisfy claim
one. Do you happen to have the cite to the extensive testimony on how all of these functions can be performed by a self-aware controller?
So there was one. I'll provide one. Let me just pull it here. Dr. Ryan was asked a question in particular, and I believe this is in the briefing, about a vehicle.
Right. This is the redirect, right?
That's correct. He was asked about, exactly. He was
so asked 6144 to 45?
6114 to 45.
Okay.
That's correct. Where he initially testified on direct, because he was asked just off the top of his head, did he know of a way of doing this? Did he know of a way of detecting a vehicle's presence, in close proximity to the garage without a sensor? And he said, I can't think of one. And then when he was asked about HomeLink, which is Chamberlain technology that's in the garage door, the buttons that you have in your car, that's all originated from Chamberlain. When he was asked about that, then he recognized that, yes, you can detect the presence based on the fact that your signal came from HomeLink. That's not a sensor, that's control data. But that was an example that he gave of that he could come up with. And there wasn't this particular claim five was not, and I may have overstated when I said extensive testimony. There was testimony on this. It was challenged. At some point, TTI stopped challenging the expert on that point, but there was testimony on this.
Have your prices to Home Depot or anyone else gone down since the infringement here? I know
they have.
I know Home Depot's retail prices fluctuated, but in terms of your your sales prices to Home Depot.
Yes, we've had to offer rebates. So the price of the...
Right, but then you stopped giving rebates.
Well, then we were in negotiations at the time of the preliminary injunction hearing. So TTI was under pressure to give more rebates by Home Depot. When we had the hearing, they were in the midst of negotiations with Home Depot. They have subsequently offered rebates since then. It's not in the record because it wasn't part of the PI hearing, mm-hmm. but it's, and the price has maintained at the same level of $244. So now the $268 model has been repressed in price this entire time. You can go on the website and look. It's still $244, price below the Ryobi model. Unless there are further questions.
That'll be fine. Thank you, Ms. Vidal.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. White has 4 minutes left for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor, and I'll try to be brief. On this notion of the court using self-aware as a shorthand for something else, that was an issue that was never raised, never argued below, and you won't find that anywhere in the order. That's a new argument we heard from Chamberlain only in these proceedings in the briefs, and I suggest there's just no evidence to support that at all. This idea that external sensors were denigrated in the patent, that also is false. So external sensors were embraced in the patent. We read it in column 4. You see it in the claims. For them to claim external sensors and say they're somehow denigrated flies in the face of what's in the claim language directly. The self-aware controller, as Judge Chen, you pointed out, if you adopt the construction, it renders Claim 5 inoperable. That cannot possibly be the right construction here. You also heard Chamberlain suggest that...
So far in what you're saying now, you have not said anything that's a reason to reject the construction under which it has to have the ability to... And I don't have any trouble at all using the term self-aware as a complete shorthand for what's for the notion about where the information that's being sent to the smartphone is coming from. As long as it has that ability, it can have anything else you want. So Claim 5 would be consistent. Claim 2 would be consistent. What is wrong with the claim construction that says it has to have this ability? That's actually pretty key to our invention. Can have all the other bells and whistles, but it's got to have that.
Again, the best thing I could point you to is I think that would exclude the embodiment that uses sensors for the information. If you say it has to be self-aware, then you could never have the scenario where it just relied upon external sensors. And so I think you'd be eliminating one of the two embodiments expressly disclosed in column 4. The other thing that I would point is one of the arguments you heard is that Chamberlain never suggested that claims 1 and 2 were sort of mutually exclusive, that they somehow can work together. But I think Chamberlain, and we put this in our reply brief, bears some responsibility here for this confusion, because if you look on their briefing, and this is at the Joint Appendix 3091, we have a statement from them. This is from Chamberlain's brief that says the 275 patents claim 1 recites the first scenario, referring back to that column 4, the first scenario where the controller is self-aware. And the 275 patents claim 2 corresponds to the second scenario, by reciting and relying upon external sensors. So they were the one that tried to drive this wedge between claim 1 and claim 2 and really introduce this confusion into the judges, into the proceedings and into the judge's order.
If the claim were to be construed in the way that I keep talking about, what is the best prior art that raises a substantial question of invalidity?
I think both Menard and Tizumi. So we've explained in both briefs that they do show a self-aware controller. They are aware of information that's not derived from external sensors. And because of that, we think that that would meet, even if you require a self-aware controller, that both of those pieces of prior art would show that. One last piece I want to touch on just briefly is we also raised the issue of the insubstantial or insignificant findings on irreparable harm. You've touched on a couple of pieces of that. I've got less than a minute left, so I'm not going to go into detail on that. But we believe, for the reasons stated in our briefs, that is a separate independent basis for you to vacate the preliminary injunction on just that ground alone.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.
All rise.